This is Christopher Kimball. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast. You can head over to our website, which is atkradio.com. We post our recipes, equipment reviews, taste test results, and also our wine recommendations. Enjoy this week's show. This is America's Test Kitchen from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org, and I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. This week from the Test Kitchen, everyone knows that over the last 100 years, American produce has lost flavor. Chicken is blander, celery has no taste, and tomatoes, of course, are a joke. Scientists have countered with 2,200 flavor chemicals to create new taste sensations that some would argue are identical to natural flavors. Mark Schatzker, author of The Dorito Effect, introduces us to this brave new world of laboratory foods.
If you wonder why the chicken soup you make or the chicken and dumplings doesn't taste quite the way grandma's used to taste, it's because the chicken has changed. So I see that as a huge problem because the food we should be eating is becoming less and less appealing. The other side of the coin is that flavor technology is getting better and better and better. So just as good food is getting bland, the food we shouldn't be eating is getting ever more delicious. And I think this explains why so many people are making such poor food choices.
Also on our show today, we uncover the secrets to the very best banana bread and taste test apricot preserves. But first, it's time for this week's Test Kitchen Tip. You may not spend all night worrying about the best way to store cucumbers, but we did. So we came up with three methods to test. First, we stored them loose in the vegetable drawer. Second, in a Ziploc bag. And third, we wrapped the cucumbers tightly in plastic wrap before storing them in the fridge. The worst method was the first. Stored loose, they start to soften within 5 days. Stored in a Ziploc bag, they lasted almost a week, but the cucumbers wrapped in plastic wrap lasted a full 10 days before they started to soften. The secret is this: you slow down moisture loss that occurs when cucumbers are exposed to air. That's why loose storage is worse. A bag still does offer some exposure to air, but the tightly wrapped cucumbers in plastic, those cucumbers retain their moisture for a much longer period. Coming up, we take your calls, but first we head into the test kitchen for this week's taste test.
I'm here with Jack Bishop, our tasting expert. Jack, how are you?
I'm well, Chris.
I have three little bowls of what I hope is apricot jam.
Yes.
Yes, good guess.
Good guess. Why don't you dig in with a spoon? We tasted five different brands, and the first thing we learned is that you want something that is labeled apricot preserves rather than spreadable fruit. It actually sounds good, spreadable fruit. It's going to have more fruit in it. But actually, this is a case where more fruit is not a good thing. Two things. More sugar gives you a more fluid texture. And so the spreadable fruits, they were difficult to spread. Let's put it that way. They're very thick and have a kind of stodgy texture that we really didn't like. The second thing is the spreadable fruits, they replace the sugar with other fruit juice concentrates. So they're made with grape juice, date juice, pineapple juice as a natural sweetener. But the problem is you end up tasting dates or grapes when you want to be tasting apricots. And the brands that were just made with plain old sugar, we thought were much better than the ones made with the alternates.
You know, plain old sugar is making a comeback.
Yes. Yeah. And it turned out that we liked the sweetest brands. More sugar gave you a more fluid texture that not only was easier to spread across a piece of toast, but if you're using apricot jam to glaze a tart, you know, a lot of fruit tarts, you'll use the apricot jam for that. It does a better job of that performance issue in the kitchen.
I think we're going to have a big fight here because you're emphasizing spreadable, whereas I would think you'd emphasize real apricot flavor. And I just tasted one I liked a lot, but it's probably it's the chunkiest and least spreadable of the group.
No, chunky is okay.
We
do like big pieces of fruit.
Okay.
But we don't want the sort of, there's the solid and the liquid phase in any preserve.
You're sneaky.
That solid phase of the big chunks is fine, but the sort of, you know, pectin set liquid, we want it to be a little bit fluid so that you can actually spread it. But yeah, a lot of chunks of fruit makes a great apricot preserve. You're right. The most important thing is we want it to taste like apricots. And by adding grape juice or pineapple juice or date juice, you are not going to improve the apricot flavor. So, time for you to tell me what
I
you like.
I have a clear winner.
Okay.
Or as my mother used to say, always wrong and never in doubt. The three samples, number three, I thought it was chunky. I wouldn't say it's particularly spreadable, but it did definitely taste like apricots. The second was incredibly sweet. It's just massively sweet, and I don't think it had much fruit flavor. I think the first one, it's a little paler in color. This wasn't, it was too sweet as well. Although I thought the middle one was the worst. So I would definitely pick number three as clearly the strongest.
Would you like to see what you chose?
I would love to see what I chose.
You are in agreement with the tasting panel. You chose the winner, which is Smucker's Apricot Preserves. There are no other fruits other than the apricots. We just thought it had a big apricot flavor and was the clear winner.
Now, the number two I thought was just really sweet.
This was a runner-up. This is Bon Mama. It's a more expensive. It's made just with apricots and sugar. It is a little bit sweeter, it seems to me. But I thought it had good fruit flavor. I'm not sure you were agreeing with me on that.
I remember this years ago we did a tasting. This did not do well, even though the packaging's nice. And it's expensive, isn't it? It's not cheap.
No, it is more expensive, has nicer packaging, but not necessarily better jam.
I thought the first one, which is probably Kraft or something, actually wasn't any worse than the Bon Mama.
This is one of the spreadable fruits. This is a brand called Saint Dolphore. And this is one that's made with grape juice, date juice, and has other fruit flavors. And we just felt like it didn't have the clean, sort of in-your-face apricot flavor that Smucker's does.
So I like it. The classic supermarket favorite, Smucker's Apricot Preserves, was our winner at a good price.
You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. You can find today's show, all of our weekly shows, at our website, atkradio.com, and also on iTunes. On our site, we also post our recipes, equipment reviews, wine tastings, and taste test results. Now it's time to take some calls. Of course, joining me is our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster.
Hello, Chris.
How are you, Ms. Lancaster?
Fantastic. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Carol Morton.
Hi, Carol. How are you doing?
I'm just fine.
Very good. And what can we help you with today?
Well, I have a candy recipe that I've used for 45 years. And my mother used it before me. It's a toffee, and then after you make the toffee and cool it, you cover it on both sides with semi-sweet chocolate. And I've always used just melted chocolate chips, but in recent years, they don't melt the same, and they're hard to spread.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if the chocolate chip recipes had changed. And also, I wondered if it has changed, is there some kind of semi-sweet chocolate I could get to make it easy to make again?
Semi-sweet chocolate is one of those unregulated names because
you
could be 50% sugar, you could be 20% sugar. It doesn't really mean anything. Nestle's probably has a fairly high sugar level.
Mm-hmm.
But I find chips in general full of stabilizers and emulsifiers because they have to obviously not melt in a cookie.
Are you using Nestle's?
I've used Nestle. I've used other ones too,
okay.
But mostly I had always used Nestle.
Okay.
I don't think I'd use chips at all. I would just use those 4-ounce bars, and Ghirardelli is our supermarket favorite, which is what, 60 or 65% cacao, which
That's
means,
right.
you know, it's got good flavor, but it's not overly sweet.
To address one part of your question, Carol, about has the recipe for the chips changed, it's very likely because over the years, chocolate manufacturers get their ingredients to make chocolate from various vendors. And, due to seasonality or vendor changes, the actual recipe may change, and they don't let us know that the recipes have changed. So something that you've been using for years that's performed in a
phone call for Bridget from Nestle.
Now, having said that, I agree with Chris. Chocolate chips are actually made to not melt.
Right. That's what they call them.
Chips. Yeah. And,
well,
and
they've improved their product.
Yes, they have. Unlike just plain chocolate, they usually contain more stabilizers, more emulsifiers in order to keep them in that shape during the heat exposure. So I agree with Chris getting a bar chocolate like the Ghirardelli.
Wait. What did you say?
I know. I agree with Chris.
Bridget Lancaster just said, I just want everybody who's listening to the show today said she agreed with me. This has been recorded, Bridget.
So back in terms of chocolate chips, though, we also found that the Ghirardelli chips melted easier than the Nestle.
Yeah, I just buy the bars of Ghirardelli. In general, Ghirardelli melts well.
Oh, it melts beautifully.
Chips, in general, I just don't use for melting, for cooking. That's my basic premise in life. That's why I'm so happy I've lived so long. Never use chips for melting in baking. That's all
okay,
I know.
Okay, I'll stop that then.
Immediately. Carol, thank you so much for calling.
Okay.
Thanks, Carol. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're anti-chip.
Don't use chips. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Don from Seattle.
How can we help you?
I'm a big fan of gins and tonic, and I'm curious about tonic water. Compared with other carbonated beverages, tonic water seems to have some unique characteristics. Specifically, when opening a bottle, no carbonated beverage seems likely to spurt all over the kitchen and the person holding it as tonic water. Secondly, no carbonated beverage seems to go flatter faster than tonic water. Saving unused portions of tonic water, however tightly capped, seems to be a futile exercise. And finally, most diet drinks are sweetened with aspartame, except for tonic water, which is sweetened for some reason with saccharin, and I don't care for the taste. I suspect that these are all a result of quinine that you find in tonic water, and I'm just wondering whether you have any thoughts on this.
You're absolutely right about it going flat quickly. That's why I only buy tiny little bottles. Actually, I really like tonic water. I buy they come in glass bottles, and they're kind of expensive, but it's very high quality. It's good.
The Fever Tree?
Yeah, they come in small bottles, and whether you buy that or some other brand, never buy the big liter, 2 liter bottles, because you're right, you open it, and 3 minutes later, Bridget would probably say, just get a lot of gin and drink it up quickly.
Well, the fact that they do seem to be almost overcarbonated when you open it up, that it's a surprise. But that would also explain why it goes flat so quickly, is that the carbonation is leaving the bottle so violently.
But there has to be science about why the carbonation, when the pressure is released, goes out faster than, let's say, Coke or something.
Right. I mean, perhaps there's some sort of standard for the amount of bubbles or the size of bubbles that's specific to tonic water over seltzer or a soda. I also am a fan of gin and tonic. I use the SodaStream, one of those carbonation machines.
Yeah.
They actually make a tonic water mix.
And it's decent.
It's actually quite good. But what I like about it is I can make as much or as little as I want. I haven't tried the diet version.
You buy a diet tonic water, is that right?
Me?
No.
I don't.
Don.
But Don, oh yes.
I've tried it, but I don't like it.
I hate to ask this, but how many calories are in like a serving of tonic water?
Not that much.
Yeah.
It's easy to justify the calories in tonic water.
Especially if you get gin in it. I don't think.
There you go.
It's going to be rounding error.
It's a great cocktail and you should enjoy every single calorie.
That's small bottles, SodaStream if you like. Try Fever Tree. I think their
stuff
is really high quality, which in a gin and tonic is a good idea.
Great. I'll give it a try.
Don, all right.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks, Don.
Bye. This is America's Test Kitchen. I'm Christopher Kimball here with our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster. Give us a ring anytime. That number is 855-34-COOKS. That's 855-34-COOKS. Or simply email us at questions@atkradio.com. Now it's time for another call.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
My name is Maria.
Hi, Maria. Where are you calling from?
Meridian, Idaho.
Well, do you have a question for us today?
I do. My ears perked up a few weeks ago when I heard you mention that you had a child who used to be allergic to eggs.
That's right.
Yes, I have a daughter who's allergic to eggs and a few other things.
Mm-hmm.
I like to bake for her, and I was hoping you could give me some tips on baking without eggs and how to modify recipes.
Egg allergies are so tough, especially if you like to bake. At one point, my son was allergic to eggs, both the yolk and the white. He was allergic to dairy. He was allergic to beef. And he was also allergic to tree nuts and peanuts.
Yeah, she's allergic to several of those other things, too. But I find those things easier to avoid.
Yeah.
It's the eggs that's really hard to work around.
Well, I had quite a bit of luck with an egg replacement, energy egg replacement.
Mm-hmm.
I did find a couple things with that.
How do you spell that, by the way?
I think it's inner, E-N-E-R, and then the letter G, if I remember correctly.
I think you are right.
Basically, it's a combination of tapioca starch and it's got potato starch. It also has some leavener in there. Knowing what's in there helps you to realize what it can and can't do. So I found it was great as an ingredient for cakes and cookies, you know, where the egg is not the star of the show. So things like custards, even an angel food cake where, you know, eggs make up the bulk of the recipe, that's where it was very difficult to get this to work. And, you know, I had the best luck using their instructions.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using it for an egg yolk, you would mix this amount. Egg white, you would mix that amount, and whole egg. The other thing that I found that it sometimes did to baked goods, though, is it would make them drier. So for each addition that I was substituting an egg yolk, I would make the replacement, and I would add a half a tablespoon of butter or oil to the recipe. And that helped quite a bit, you know, because you're getting rid of the fat from the egg yolk. So especially when it was 2, 3, 4, you know, eggs in a cake or something like that, I would find that I would have to add more fat.
So here's what I don't get. So if it can be used for replacement for whole eggs, whites or yolks. So if you're doing angel food cake, which is whites, obviously,
you can whip it up. It'll actually whip up.
No, it doesn't whip up that well. But the problem is at that point, you know it's not an egg. It doesn't taste, you know, it's not a great egg substitute in terms of texture.
So if you need whipped whites, it's not going to work.
No, it's not going to work.
Right.
Yeah. Marshmallow cream was actually one of my non-egg-based marshmallow cream was great for whipped egg whites.
Oh, I didn't know there was one.
That's a good idea.
Do you know a brand that's non-egg-based?
Yeah, I think Fluff is not egg-based, if I remember correctly.
I'll have to look for that.
Yeah.
One of the problems that I've had with chocolate cake that I make, and I make biscotti, and I tried to make it without eggs, is that it doesn't really cook through to the center. And the cake, I have to cook it for so long to make it not pudding in the middle that it's so dry on the outside. The biscotti, I could cook it forever and it won't cook in the middle.
Wow.
And I have not tried, as you suggested, adding the extra fat, and maybe that would help. But do you have any other advice?
The extra fat's definitely going to help out with the chocolate cake because it's not going to dry out on the outside. The other thing is you might want to lower the oven just a bit because it does tend to not rise as much as a regular cake. And depending on your recipe, you may even want to up the amount of baking powder just to give it a little bit more lift so it'll lighten the load a bit. But the butter or the fat is going to help a lot because you're right, cakes would get that kind of skin around them and then the interior is a little bit too moist. So I think lowering the oven, letting it go a little bit longer and adding more fat so that it doesn't dry out is going to be helpful.
We should get a recording of Bridget saying, just add some more fat. Because about half the calls we get, we could go have our engineer hit the button, the fat button.
It really is tough, especially, you know, if you do like to bake muffins, cakes, pies, you know, all these other things. And eggs are a huge part of our
But it would, just so I understand, it would work for pancakes, muffins, those sort of things.
Yeah.
It's just custards and egg white desserts that's not great for.
That's right.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Hope
and I know my daughter will too.
All right. Well,
thanks, Maria.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to America's Test Kitchen. You can find today's show, all of our weekly shows, on iTunes, TuneIn, and also on our very own website, atkradio.com. That's where we post our recipes, tastings, and testings. Coming up after the break, I interview Mark Schatzker. He's author of The Dorito Effect, about science, flavor, and junk foods. You know, I could probably start a shaving museum since I have all manner of straight razors, safety razors, shaving brushes, creams, and mugs. The curious thing is that I find myself coming back to my orange-handled Harry's razor. It gives me a great shave. It does have a distinctive bright orange handle, and it gets the job done. You know, Harry's was started by two guys who were passionate about shaving, and then they ended up buying a blade factory in Germany that had been in business for almost a century. And the cost of the razor is much less than the drugstore brands. In fact, you can get a starter kit for just $15. That includes the razor, three blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. As an added bonus, you can also get $5 off your first purchase with our code KITCHEN. After using this code, you can get an entire month's worth of shaving for just $10. And shipping is always free. So go to harrys.com now, and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in our code KITCHEN with your first purchase. That's HARRYS.com. And enter coupon code KITCHEN at checkout for $5 off the starter set and start shaving smarter today. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Everyone knows that ranch-dipped hot wing Doritos are not naturally flavored, but what is natural? Scientists would argue that a chemical is a chemical, whether derived from plants or created in the lab. So as our produce becomes more and more tasteless, food companies have created over 2,000 new flavor chemicals that have changed how we eat, how we taste, and also how we live. Mark Schatzker, he's the author of The Dorito Effect, has investigated the science of these new flavors, including how our brains perceive taste and flavor in the first place. I started by asking him to define natural flavors. So let's wind back to a period before we had chemical flavorings. Fruits and vegetables had, at that point, natural flavors, and they did a variety of things for us. What do natural flavors do for us?
Well, it's funny you say that. Natural flavors is actually a very confused term because, legally speaking, you can refer to a synthetic flavor, which is to say a flavor created in a lab, produced in a factory, as a, quote, natural flavor. So that's a really loaded term. I suppose what we're talking about is real flavor or flavor made by nature. So the question is, yes, why does food have flavor? The first thing I'll say is that flavor is really important from an evolutionary point of view. The flavor sensing system that we have takes up more DNA than anything else, more than your eyes, more than your brain. So obviously evolution thinks it's really important. And the reason it's there is because prior to the modern age, we faced the task, like all animals, of getting nutrients. We live in this environment with all sorts of possible foods, some of which might be good for us, might be poison. How do we know what to eat? And flavor is that system. Flavor is our way of sensing what's in food before we eat it. So that's why we sense flavor in food, and that's why food emanates flavor. It's kind of a back and forth.
There were two little points in your book about this there I thought really fascinating. You said 1926, there was a pediatrician in Chicago, and he tested toddlers. And
Clara Davis.
And one such child had a vitamin D deficiency and of his or her own volition drank cod liver oil. That's pretty interesting.
It's amazing. This is an incredible study. We could never repeat it today because the ethics of this kind of experimentation have changed. But basically, Clara Davis asked a simple question. If you let kids decide what they wanted to eat, would they eat themselves to death into some kind of a deficiency, or would they just snack on the bad stuff all day? Or would they do a reasonable job? And what she found is they did a very good job. And that's the most interesting example, the one you mentioned, because one of these toddlers entered the study with a severe vitamin D deficiency. And they put out a little glass of cod liver oil, which, as we know, is something kids can't stand. And this kid drank it of his own volition until the rickets went away.
There was another comment you made in the book. You said fruits and vegetables are full of natural, quote-unquote, toxins to make you stop eating at a certain point, and junk food does not. Explain that.
Fruits and vegetables are filled with thousands upon thousands of compounds, plant compounds. They call them plant secondary compounds, which are there for all sorts of reasons. Some of them are there to get critters to stop eating them. They're there typically for what are considered strategic purposes. The thing to remember about toxicity, it's a matter of dose. So just because something is toxic doesn't mean it will kill you. For example, water could kill you, but you'd have to drink a ton of it. So the thinking is that there are these chemicals in fruits and vegetables. We have a limit. We can consume a certain amount before our body says, okay, you've had enough, don't have any more. You can think of it this way, if it sounds strange and highly scientific. There's only so much oregano you'll put in your spaghetti sauce before it would essentially become inedible.
The book is called The Dorito Effect for a reason, I assume, and it had to do with something that happened in 1962. What was that?
Well, the Dorito, something people are generally unaware of, is the first Dorito was just a salted tortilla chip, and it didn't do that well. The Dorito didn't become the success that we know it to be today until they flavored it. The first one tasted like taco. The next iteration of Doritos tasted like nacho cheese. This is the point of my book, that the fundamental change in our food system hasn't been about salt or carbs or sugar. It's been about flavor. And the Dorito is a great example of how powerful flavor technology has become and what that lets us do to food. And I'm curious about what are the consequences.
So there are really two parts to this. There are how food is hybridized and grown, tomatoes, chicken, for example. You mentioned 1923, it took 16 weeks to produce a 2-pound broiler, and, you know, 50 years later, it was 8.5 weeks. Tomatoes, you know, they created a slow ripening version of the tomato, and that simply means less flavor. So you have, without adding chemical-enhanced flavoring, you have just production of food that's designed for weight and volume and speed that produces lower quality and less flavor. Is that correct?
Exactly. There's two parts to what I call the flavor problem. The first is that everything we grow, the whole foods that we should be eating, are getting blander and blander and blander. If you wonder why the chicken soup you make or the chicken and dumplings doesn't taste quite the way grandma's used to taste, it's because the chicken has changed. So I see that as a huge problem because the food we should be eating is becoming less and less appealing. The other side of the coin is that flavor technology is getting better and better and better. So just as good food is getting bland, the food we shouldn't be eating is getting ever more delicious. And I think this explains why so many people are making such poor food choices.
Yeah, there's some really good examples in your book. And this really rang a bell. Older recipes, and I've gone through lots of old American cookbooks from the 19th century, talk about fried chicken, and it's just served or cooked with salt and pepper, nothing else. And now you mention that's obvious, but for a reason, because the chicken actually had flavor. There was a cookbook in 1896, Good Cooking, that said, quote, full-grown poultry has the best flavor, of course, just like coq au vin, which was probably a 3 or 4 year old bird.
Exactly.
And our birds now are, you know, 2 months old.
It's too young. We eat giant babies. Not only that, I mean, the flavor of meat is partly determined by the age of the animal when you kill it, but it's also determined by what they eat. And chickens now eat a very highly refined diet, generally corn and soybeans. That doesn't taste like anything. So we've really mastered the art of making chicken that tastes like cardboard.
So let's get into the chemistry of this a little bit. So a single aroma molecule can have different parts, of course, and therefore stimulate different receptors on your palate. So a single receptor on your palate, the tongue or palate, it can be stimulated by different types of molecules. So it's a lot more complicated than something sweet, let's say, in sugar.
It's extraordinarily complicated.
Would just stimulate a sweet receptor. So explain why it's more complicated.
Well, because it is so difficult to predict how different aromas are going to work. The sensations are extraordinarily complex. You know, we really register it on an emotional level, which is the thing that's so interesting. We tend to think, we have almost an arrogance that we're so smart, we can identify this, we know that. But the really interesting thing about flavor is how it makes you feel. You know immediately when you taste something, or even if you smell it, if it's appetizing or if it's repulsive. And that is instant. And there's a tremendous amount of high-tech equipment in your nose and mouth that's being engaged, and your brain works really quickly. But the actual science of it is mind-bogglingly complex.
So what's really interesting about the story, lots of things, but the most interesting part for me is this. At first, you're trying to replicate a quote-unquote pre-industrial flavor, let's say like vanilla, for example, which comes out of a plant. And then you have foods that are blander, like chicken or tomatoes, and you would think that industry would try to enhance the flavor of that now bland product. What's really happened now is something entirely different, which is like the beautiful woman standing next to the sports car. You know, you're not selling a sports car, you're selling an idea and an emotion. So you had some examples. For example, if you're going to flavor a cracker, if you wanted to sell it to people who like the spa experience, the flavor combinations you might describe as tame, steady, or mild. If you're selling the crackers for a sports bar, they might be wild, active, daring, eager, and enthusiastic. So flavorings are not there to make up for the lack of flavor in a base product so much. They're there to sell you on almost an experience, right?
It's almost to divert your attention in a way. Yeah, that's exactly correct. And it can be very appealing for that reason. It almost becomes lifestyle advertising through flavor. And that's exactly what they would do. If they were aiming a snack food in the wellness sphere, they would want flavors that maybe green tea, for example, or something piney, something that reminded you of the forest and seems natural. But if you're gearing something to young males, you want some chili, you want an edge of adventure and risk and, you know, high tolerance, that kind of a thing.
So where are we now? We're at the point where real flavors are diminishing because of the nature of, you know, agribusiness. We've invented chemical flavorings, over 2,000 different flavorings, which we can combine in millions of ways to enhance the commercial value of products in the supermarket. So now we're at a point where flavoring has taken on a whole new concept. Where do we go from here? It seems like humans have now been trained to want tastes that don't exist in nature and are designed to fit their lifestyle.
it's hard to go back to just a good tasting tomato, right?
I think we can. I think where we've got to is not a good place, mainly because these flavors have a nutritional, in a state of nature, flavor has a nutritional component to it. There was a study published in the journal Science a few years ago that found that the 20 flavors we most love in tomatoes, and that's significant because there's about 400 different flavor compounds, we ignore about 380 and we completely zone in on 20. And they're all synthesized from important nutrients like omega-3 fats, vitamin A, carotenoids. Essentially, the flavor we look for in a tomato is a reflection of that tomato's nutrition. So flavor, on some level, equals nutrition. If you then isolate those flavors and you start to put them in soft drinks and you put them in potato chips and you put them in chicken nuggets, you're creating the sensation of what your body thinks is nutritious food, but you're not delivering. So I think this technology, as fun as it is, and as good as it's been to the bottom line for a lot of snack food makers, is not good for us. I think this has a lot to do with why so many people are eating too much. But the other thing I'd argue is that these flavor combinations we've gotten so good at contriving aren't actually that good. I'm a food lover. I write a lot about food. I travel. And I find the journey for a lot of food lovers ends up going towards real food, simplicity. Life becomes a journey to find the greatest tomato, the greatest steak, the greatest chicken. I think that's where there's still better pleasure in nature than there is in the lab. I still believe that.
I'm with you. I'm going to stick with the optimistic side of this. Let's go back to natural flavors. I spoke to our scientist on staff about this as well. So explain what a natural flavor is that is derived from a plant, for example, and what you can do in the lab. And my question for you is, at the end of the day, the final chemical or chemicals you end up with, is there any difference?
Okay, so yeah, let's use the example of vanillin. That's the character impact compound in vanilla. It's simply stated what makes vanilla smell like vanilla or taste like vanilla. You can make it two ways. You can make it artificially. So let's say if you made it artificially, you might start with a petrochemical, which is often the base for chemicals that the chemical industry makes. So you start with a petrochemical, and then you modify it using very complex modern chemistry. You add this chemical group here, that chemical group there, and voila, you're left with a vat of pure vanillin. That would be called artificial vanillin. Well, let's say instead you started with a compound you extracted from pine needles. Now, it wasn't quite vanillin, but chemically speaking, it was close. So you're sitting going, well, how do I change this into vanillin? Well, you might heat it. You might use a quote-unquote natural acid like vinegar. You might put it through a centrifuge. These are considered natural by the FDA. You would wind up with two vats, one called artificial vanillin, one called natural vanillin. Chemically speaking, they are identical.
In other words, someone extracted the flavor of peaches by reducing peaches down.
No, it's not even that. They didn't get it from peaches. That would be too expensive. What they did was they used a gas chromatograph to figure out what are the flavor compounds in peaches. Let's say they came up with 20 of them. And then they found cheaper sources. Maybe lawn clippings would be one. Maybe bark would be another. Maybe there's a yeast that makes the other. They would produce these all separately in separate vats and then combine them and call it natural flavor. And you'd smell it and you go, wow, that smells just like a peach. But guess what? Nutritionally, it could not be further from a peach.
Is there anything in the research for the book or an experience you had in doing the research that was really, you know, just blew you away, was particularly emotional or interesting or unusual?
One of the most exciting things to me, there's this guy at the University of Florida, Harry Klee, who's been trying to make tomatoes taste better for 20 years. The thing that's so interesting is that he's just after making tomatoes taste better, but it's what he's discovered along the way. The first was that story I told you about the relationship between the flavor of tomato and the nutrition of a tomato, which to me is an enormous piece of news. But the second is even more interesting. They were analyzing, what they would do is they would analyze all the flavors in tomatoes, and then they would get all these tasting panels to rate tomatoes. And they started to compare the data. And what they found one day was that there was one tomato that didn't have that much sugar in it that everyone said tasted sweeter than another tomato that had way more sugar in it. And what they discovered is that the flavor compounds in tomatoes, these things that tingle your aroma receptors, can actually make it taste more sweet. You can make a tomato taste sweeter without adding so much as a single grain of sugar. And I think that that tells us two things. The first is the incredible power that nature has to thrill and delight us. And the second is this is really exciting because if we all want to eat better, and I think the truth is the path to better health is through better tasting food.
The perfume and food industries have a lot in common. You know, perfumers and flavorists combine dozens of different chemical compounds to produce a desirable scent or flavor. Now let's take vanilla. The dominant compound is vanillin, but natural vanilla extract made from the fruit of the vanilla orchid also contains dozens of other natural compounds that round out its scent and flavor. Now, artificial vanilla, that was originally made from pine cones, by the way, is nothing more than the base compound vanillin. This cheap substitute never had the rich, full aroma of the real thing, at least until 1978. In that year, using gas chromatography, the McCormick Company finally isolated an elusive compound that provided the signature piney taste of real vanilla. These days, artificial vanilla tastes much like the real thing. And that, in a nutshell, is the holy grail of the flavor industry. Our brains just can't tell the difference. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Coming up after the break, as we do every week, we answer your cooking questions. We also learn the easiest way to make the ultimate banana bread. You know, I've done countless home renovation projects, and to be honest, many of them have not worked out quite as well as I had hoped. So let me make a suggestion. The next time you get the urge to renovate, schedule some time at a Ferguson showroom. Let their experts show you the latest in kitchen, bath, and lighting products. That includes appliances, of course, faucets and fixtures. And take it from me, their showrooms really do feel more like your house than a warehouse. So take the personal approach and schedule a consultation today at Ferguson.com and visit a Ferguson near you. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Coming up, as we do every week, we answer your cooking questions. Give us a ring, 855-34-COOKS. One more time, 855-34-COOKS. But now it's time for a chat with Adam Gopnik. He's a contributing writer for The New Yorker and also our resident philosopher. Adam, how are you?
I am extremely well today, Chris, because I just got back sometime yesterday from Iceland. Have you ever been to Iceland?
No, I've interviewed a chef in Reykjavik, but I've never been.
Well, we just were in Reykjavik for a week, and it was one of the thrilling and startlingly gastronomic experiences of my life. My wife, I should explain, his name is Martha, comes from an Icelandic family. So it was very much for her a trip back to see the family farm and show the children, the relatives, and all of that. Iceland, as you probably know, is the most beautifully barren part of the entire inhabited globe. It's a land made out of lava, and it has almost no natural resources. It has no grass. It has no farmland to speak of, but it has a fantastic food culture. And I was so impressed and got to thinking about how scarcity of exactly that kind often produces wonderful cooking. Now, you should understand, first of all, that the foundation, kind of the reservoir at the base of all Icelandic cooking, is coffee. You will never find any people on the face of the planet who drink as much coffee as they drink in Iceland. I was prepared for this because my wife, who, as I say, is of Icelandic stock, she starts drinking extremely strong coffee at about 8 in the morning and continues drinking it all day until finally around midnight she takes one last large cup of that coffee and then goes down for a peaceful slumber while I lie awake despite not having been caffeinated since sometime before noon.
Well, you're caffeinated by association.
Exactly. And if you read the fiction of Laxness, Halldór Laxness, the great Icelandic Nobel Prize winner, when the peasants who are celebrating anything in his wedding or funeral in his fiction stop, they don't drink beer, they don't have flagons of mead, they have 4 to 8 cups of coffee to celebrate. So Iceland floats on this great sea of coffee. And here's the first thing that fascinated me about that, Chris. It's that nobody in Iceland thinks much about or talks much about the overwhelming fact that coffee has to be imported from very far away. And so for centuries, Icelanders, through frozen ports and terrible weather, have been bringing in these enormous quantities of coffee. And it made me think, Chris, about how so often something that's essential to our gastronomic identity, to our food identity, comes from far away, and yet we have a certain kind of amnesia about its distance.
You know, I once sat down with Alice Waters a couple years ago, and she gave me the local speech, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
And I said, well, I thought you were addicted to French Chev.
Uh-huh.
And she said, oh. Yeah, so I'm like, oh, that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think that we all live with that kind of amnesia in our culinary lives, right? There's something that we depend on, we think of as belonging to us and belonging to our food culture, that actually comes from far away. But I've never seen such a, if you like, egregious or at least extravagant case of it as with Icelanders and their culture of coffee. That was one thing that was quite overwhelming and instructive to me. The other thing that was overwhelming and instructive is how wonderful the food is in a country with almost no natural resources, very, very limited agriculture. Pretty much the only thing that you can raise on Icelandic soil, on that volcanic rock, are sheep.
So did you eat a fermented shark sandwich? And also smoked puffin, I think, is a specialty there.
You know your Icelandic cooking, right. Chris, because those are both great delicacies of Iceland. We went all the way for smoked puffin. Dear Icelandic friends and family warned us that the fermented shark is really not something you want to be trying on your first visit.
It's a bridge too far, yes.
Yes, that's exactly. But we ate wonderfully, nonetheless. One of the finest restaurant meals I've ever had in my life was at a restaurant in Reykjavik called Dill. Maybe that was the chef.
That's the chef, yes.
You spoke to in that time. Well, his reputation is extremely well-earned. It's all about just using the local ingredients, which are, again, basically pickled cod, lamb, and skyr, yogurt, and doing astonishing things with them. And it occurred to me that that isn't just an oddity of Iceland, though Iceland probably takes that idea of using scarcity as the basis for a gastronomy of richness about as far as you can take it. But when you stop and think about it, there's a kind of inverse relationship, isn't there? There's almost a kind of devil's theory of good eating, that the less you have on hand, very often, the richer, the more interesting, and the more wonderful the plates you serve will be.
Well, it's like Italian food was, you know, was not a rich cuisine.
Right.
And then they brought it to America, and all of a sudden you had meatballs the size of your head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why we love the true peasant cuisine of Sicily or Sardinia or of southern Italy, exactly because it has those qualities. And I've never seen it expressed, as I say, so at such an extreme of scarcity and of pleasure simultaneously as in Iceland.
You know, I never would have thought this, but deep down, Adam, you're a flinty, hardcore New Englander. I mean, you really embody the best of being a Vermonter, which is scarcity and difficulty.
I would never have thought of it that way. I basically think of myself as somebody who genetically had to learn the virtues of scarcity while being pursued by Cossacks across the plains of Russia, which was basically my family background. I should add, Chris, that one of the things we learned while we were in Iceland, we had confirmed, is that it is indeed the fact that my wife's side of the family descends, illegitimately, but descends from one of the great Icelandic nationalist politicians of the 19th century. Her great-grandmother was the illegitimate daughter of Jóhann Sigurðsson, a great Icelandic politician. And I pointed out to my children that this gives them now two paths in life. They can follow my family's path of fleeing from Cossacks while selling rags, or they can follow their mother's family path of sleeping with highly influential people. And I think it's obvious which one leads to a richer life.
In both ways, you have to drink a lot of coffee.
That's exactly right, Chris.
Adam, thank you so much. You can listen to today's show at atkradio.com and also on iTunes. Right now, it's time to take a few more calls. And joining me once again is our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I'm back. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
Lena Lopez from Sacramento, California.
How can we help you today?
I have a question because I made a turkey stew in my crock pot. And I put all natural ingredients in, and I had it set on low, and I had it cooking for about 5 hours. And I opened it up, and I smelled it. Everything was great. And then I mixed in a little bit of cornstarch with some water to kind of thicken it a little bit, and I let it sit for like another 20 minutes. When I went to open it to serve it, the smell of ammonia was so strong, it burned my lungs and my eyes.
Oh, wow.
What?
And I still don't understand how this ammonia bomb came out of my turkey stew.
This is like the Omen or the Amityville Horror.
Mm-hmm.
Like, strange things start happening in the in your house. Exactly. The flies congregating in the closet.
No.
I do have a question. The cornstarch, could you describe the container which contained the cornstarch?
I put it in Tupperware that I leave in my freezer.
And have you used the cornstarch from this before for other things?
Yes.
Stumped.
Well, thank you for calling. I think Bridget and I are thinking the same thing, that cornstarch is fairly inert
right.
in terms of a chemical reaction with anything in the pot.
Yeah, I can't see how it's going to cause anything like an ammonia.
But there's something that's a white powder that looks just like a baking soda, which is alkaline, the opposite of acidic. And that, I believe, could combine with the proteins to form ammonia.
Yeah, it breaks down the turkey protein. That's what I was thinking, too, because, you know, the best-selling brand of cornstarch comes in a yellow container. And baking soda also comes in that kind of orangey yellow. That's the only thing I could think of.
Is there any chance you use baking soda instead of cornstarch?
You know, it very well could be possible because I do recall several months ago where I bought both of those at the same time. And that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah.
It's Holmes and Watson here. That was good.
You can definitely taste it.
How much quote-unquote cornstarch did you add to this?
A tablespoon.
Oh, okay. A tablespoon of baking soda is a lot.
Did you notice if the mixture thickened at all?
It did a little bit, but it didn't totally soak in. So I could see like traces of white. And I thought that was a little bit
It was baking
strange.
Soda, I think.
Yeah, I do too. I think it was baking soda, especially if it didn't really thicken enough.
Yeah, I'm still surprised it was that extreme. But a tablespoon of baking soda is a lot of baking soda.
Yeah.
So, okay, I think that's the answer. Throw out your cornstarch and your baking soda and start over again.
Yeah, especially in a covered pot where it's simmering away, you're really going to get a buildup of that ammonia smell then.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Kathy from Seattle, Washington.
So how can we help you?
I really need a Chinese vegetable cleaver. I looked around and I don't even know what I'm looking for. What am I looking for if I'm going to buy a Chinese vegetable cleaver?
Well, it's a good question. I have one. The winner in our testing a couple of years ago was the MAC, M-A-C, 6.5 inch, I think, 6 or 7 inch vegetable cleaver. The thing about it I really like, and I just started using it a lot in the last few months, is that it's very thin. And so when you cut vegetables, you get a very clean, very sharp cut. It's much more precise than a European chef's knife.
Which is beveled.
Yeah, and this will go right through anything in an instant. You can get extremely fine slices and thin slices. You seem to have more control over it because it's a little smaller. Chef's knife's usually 8 inches or 10 inches. The MAC is the name, and it's expensive, though. I think it's $100.
Yep.
But I use it more for slicing than, I mean, the chef's knife's good for heavy-duty chopping. But this is very good for precision work, and it's a lovely knife, and it doesn't seem to get dull very quickly either.
No. It's lightweight, too, which is what I like about it.
So
well, that's great.
Highly
I will
recommend
put that in my shopping cart.
There you go.
Okay, so it's the MAC 6.5-inch cleaver, vegetable cleaver, and it's $90, $100.
Something like that. And it's actually a Japanese vegetable cleaver.
Right. There you go.
Great. Well,
take care.
Thanks for your help.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, Kathy.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is America's Test Kitchen. Give us a ring anytime at 855-34-COOKS. That's 855-34-COOKS. Or email us at questions@atkradio.com. Now it's time for this week's recipe challenge, Ultimate Banana Bread. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris.
This week's recipe challenge is the Ultimate Banana Bread, but I have a little caveat here.
Okay.
I'm very suspicious of recipes that start with bad produce. I mean, this is like a fruit that's kind of gone bad. Now let's see what we can do with it, you know, to sort of salvage it.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a salvage operation or is this actually worth doing?
See, Chris, I thought your frugal Vermont nature would really be in tune with that.
There is that, yes.
So, Chris, no, this is not just an excuse to use up old fruit. You really want bananas that are very heavily speckled, even turning a little bit black for this recipe. The reason being that they contain a lot less starch and a lot more sugar at that point. So they're a lot softer, but you get a lot more caramelization and the flavor is a lot nicer. So we're starting with very ripe bananas, but we also did another thing, which is we looked at most recipes out there and they call for generally 3 bananas for an average size loaf pan. plan, we decided to double that. We decided to see what we could do, adding 6 bananas and then dealing with whatever textural issues would arise from that. So we started with 6 bananas, and we found the reason that most people don't do that is they're loaded with moisture at that point, and you end up with really dense, almost custardy style banana bread. So that wasn't going to work for us, but we really liked the banana flavor we got out of that. So, Chris, we found a workaround actually using the microwave. So we take 5 of the bananas and we place them in a bowl covered with plastic wrap, and we microwave them for about 5 minutes. And you'll see that a ton of liquid comes out, usually about 1/2 cup and up to 3/4 cup. So that liquid we wanted to get out when we made our bread, but we also like the flavor of it. So we actually decided to cook it down. So we pop it on the stovetop, cook it down for about 5 minutes, really concentrate it, and then we can incorporate it back into the bread.
So the problem you're trying to solve is not enough banana flavor in banana bread.
That's right, Chris. So we wanted the most banana flavor we could, but also have a really nice texture. We don't want it to be too sludgy and mushy, and we don't want it to be dry.
Now, you have a loaf here. I noticed there are bananas on top, quite a few. So that's the remaining banana goes on top?
Exactly. That's the remaining one. We slice it on the bias into nice strips, and we line 2 sides of the bread with it. So you get this really nice effect, and they caramelize in the oven, too.
So you've actually gone from tasty to tasty and pretty.
Tasty and
You're
pretty.
You're doing both.
Yes.
So let's have a taste.
All right.
So the first thing is it's still moist. It's not a dry bread. It still has moist, but it's not custardy.
Exactly.
Well, if you don't like bananas, you shouldn't make this recipe because it has a massive amount of banana flavor. This is banana bread that actually tastes like banana bread.
Mm-hmm.
Just imagine if you can make zucchini bread that tastes like zucchini.
Would we want that?
No. So, Dan, thank you. This is, in fact, the ultimate banana bread.
You're welcome, Chris.
Thanks for listening to America's Test Kitchen. If you want to listen to more of our shows, or if you missed any of today's show, go to atkradio.com. There we post our recipes, taste test results, and also our kitchen equipment reviews. This week we talked about artificial flavors, and I did have a final thought. The book, The Dorito Effect, made me think that supermarkets have become a form of virtual reality. Celery looks like celery, but doesn't taste like it. Chicken has skin and bones, but no flavor. Low-fat yogurt is white and creamy, but has nothing in common with the real deal. Most of what is sold in a supermarket, although it claims to be food, is really not. These are base, tasteless foodstuffs that are flavored chemically to appeal to our sense of ourselves, to make us feel thinner or healthier, or to make our lives more exciting. Doritos offers almost 100 different varieties, including Peking duck, atomic chili lemon, and all-nighter cheeseburger. Science fiction writers have promised that virtual reality is just around the corner. Well, it is just around the corner. It's alive and well on the shelves of your local supermarket. You know, there are times even in my household when I just don't have the energy or the time to make dinner. So instead of a bowl of cold cereal or a quick omelet, there is another solution, and it's called Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers all the ingredients you need to make first-rate meals at home. Perfectly portioned ingredients come with an easy-to-follow recipe for creating great meals in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like Thai chicken meatballs and red coconut curry and bok choy, or pan-seared steaks with green peppercorns and roasted fingerling potatoes. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/ATK to get your first 2 meals free. America's Test Kitchen is produced by America's Test Kitchen Productions in association with WGBH. Our executive producer is Melissa Baldino, co-executive producer Stephanie Stender, associate producer Caitlin Hammond, production assistant Madeline Heising, senior audio engineer is Alan Mattis, segment editing by Melissa Allison with Sydney Lewis and Vicki Merrick, post-production by Jay Allison and Atlantic Public Media. Production help by Debbie Paddock, theme music by the Mahotel of Queens, additional music by George Brandel Egloff. America's Test Kitchen Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.